Hello, I'm Preston Schlankofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. This week's episode is about the crisis affecting our nation and the world, COVID-19. Drew Bumbeck and I addressed pandemic influenza in our first in the series when we recorded episode 42 in September of 2019. We followed it up with episode Emerging and Reemerging Diseases, also recorded in September 2019. This was before coronavirus was on anyone's radar screen. We have had multiple episodes with this as a theme or in our conversation with episodes 44 and 45, and specifically in 45, which was a update on COVID-19. Then we had Dr. Joe Alton on, and we discussed the virus issue for a good portion of the show. This show, we have Ryan Broughton, who is a retired emergency manager from the city of Denver. He brings us a huge amount of knowledge on this current status of the virus. You will be able to find his contact information in the show notes for this episode. Please help me welcome Ryan to Civil Defense Radio. Hello, Ryan. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Thanks for your call.
Yes, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Now, we're both members in an organization. It's the Secure the Grid Coalition, and we have a national leaders call on Fridays. And for the last couple of weeks, you have given us a fantastic overview of this COVID-19 threat and some information that personally I have not seen or read anywhere in some of my voluminous reading that I do. So before we get into that, can you give us a brief description of your background and what you're doing now?
Absolutely. I've worked in emergency services since 1988, starting doing rescue and emergency medical services in Texas. And I've worked in emergency management as a full-time emergency manager since 1994. I currently head a global emergency management and homeland security consulting and support services firm, Bravo Team Solutions. I believe you're putting that link in your information.
Yes.
Previously, I served as the emergency manager and homeland security director for the city and county of Denver, city of San Jose, and as the emergency manager for both the U.S. Army worldwide and the U.S. Navy worldwide. So, relevant to as we're talking about COVID-19 and what the virus that causes that, SARS-CoV-2, I have a degree in biology with an emphasis in virology and epidemiology, and a subspecialty from Department of Defense in chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear defense. So this is something I've managed before with H1N1, SARS, and MERS-CoV. So this is something I'm pretty familiar with on the emergency management side. And then on the technical side, I draw that information just like you do from the specialists, from the doctors, from the epidemiologists, from the people that have the best information that's available.
So it sounds like you have a lot of experience in the emergency management field, and you've studied this type of virus and this pandemics and things. Can you just give us a quick overview of what a pandemic is and why it's something that we should really worry about?
Well, there's three words that we commonly use. Endemic, which means that it's native, circulating in the community, may be seasonal, it may be full-time. An example is the common cold. The common cold, or which is, by the way, often caused by a coronavirus, just a different one. Or influenza, which is endemic in many cases to the world and has been for 2,000 years. So we know that these diseases continue to circulate in our community. We build up some herd immunity, which means the vast majority of the people have been exposed to the virus over the course of their lifetime. And we also have vaccines for some of those diseases, such as influenza, which currently about 40.3% of U.S. Citizens and residents actually bothered to get. So we have a vaccine, we have some native immunity to it, but it's endemic. We know it's going to be there, so we build capacity for it. So, for example, the hospitals, the mortuaries, the everybody's built into their capacity. Every season we're going to have flu. And that influenza season usually runs about eight months, and that's endemic to how we deal with disease in the United States. Then we have epidemics. We have novel diseases that come out and start into our community. And those could be ones that we think we've gotten rid of, like measles, where we get rid of a disease. We have a good vaccine. We have good herd immunity. And then people stop taking vaccines and therefore start spreading it again. And so an example of measles, which is, well, very often considered the most contagious disease out there. One person with measles will typically get 10 to 12 other people with sick with measles if they don't have immunity and they don't have the vaccine. Then there's pandemics. The note here is when we're talking about the pandemic, and I know the WHO, the World Health Organization, was somewhat slow in declaring a pandemic. Typically, that means that you have sustained human-to-human transmission in two or more World Health Organization regions, think continents, and it is usually novel. In other words, the background is people have not been exposed to this before. So the global spread of the disease is to be expected. It's a novel virus, no immunity, no vaccine, a globalized population. I mean, how many people are finally learning that cruises and aircraft and supply chains are all globalized and people are all over the world from all different nations? This disease is contagious, or most of the data is much more contagious than the flu, with a higher serious case rate and a higher case fatality rate in an overwhelmed environment. Healthcare emergency management systems are working at capacity before this, you throw in SARS-CoV-2 and the COVID-19 disease. And then there's very little to no reserve capacity. We operate at capacity every day. When people say that there's X number of beds available, the actual answer is there's the number of beds that are available are the number of beds in use. Because the healthcare organizations, every 4 to 8 hours, are rebalancing their staffing and their equipment. So there may be additional beds, but there may not be the additional staff to operate those beds available right then, right there.
Right.
And overall, as you, I'm sure, know, we just have insufficient readiness for a pandemic, which is what makes it different. When I said endemic, we're exposed to it all the time. We build that into our system. So any comparison to the flu acts like this is a known quantity, and it isn't. It's a novel disease, and we don't have the immunity. We don't have the vaccine. We don't have the experience with it. So when you get to epidemic, it's challenging maybe socially, getting people to vaccinate, or maybe getting people to social distance. We were talking about social distancing last year with measles. Should people that are unvaccinated, with their kids being unvaccinated, be allowed to go to public school? Where the whole idea of vaccination is that it protects the entire community. Same thing here now with the social distancing with COVID-19. We're doing social distancing because it's the way to break the chain of transmission, whether that's in measles last year or now with COVID-19. So that's why I think it's the most, why we have to really focus on it, why we have to put a lot of resources to it, is that it's novel. We're not prepared for it. We're not experienced with it. And we don't have the capacity to deal with this additive to a normally bad influenza season.
Right. Yeah. And that makes it a little scarier than just a regular flu and all that. Especially with the hype that the media has given this, it I think they blew it out of proportion, but it is a serious virus. We just are getting inundated with fear mongering, and there's, you know, a lot of panic driven in the population because of that, I think, and there should be more responsibility in the reporting.
Well, I think the challenge here is also that neither the media nor even the public are informed about emergencies, informed about what their responsibility is, and then being informed about what it's actually going to do. The fact is, the data out of China was intermittent and somewhat questionable. Mm-hmm. They changed the way they counted the numbers of coronavirus patients four different times that we know of. We know that the date of the first patient goes back as far as 17 December now. So we know that there were up to 180 patients in China, in Hubei province, prior to the World Health Organization ever being informed. So the trouble is, if you don't test everybody, if you don't have good, solid data that you can trust, it can be scary. It can be scary for media. It can be scary for physicians if you don't really know what the serious case rate is, if you don't really know how well it spreads. We know that this disease has spread and caused viral meningitis in cerebral spinal fluid.
Wow.
Well, that doesn't happen in other coronaviruses. So now we have cases, at least a documented case, where we have viral meningitis being caused by this disease. And you have to treat that completely different than the respiratory version. Some of the patients that came in early, it doesn't seem to be consistent, but some of the patients that came in early didn't come in with respiratory problems. They came in with gastrointestinal problems. So we know that there's different reactions among the population, and we don't have enough data, enough research yet. But keep in mind, Hippocrates talked about influenza. We know influenza.
Right.
This whole term, influenza, is influence of the stars, which is from Venice, and they created this quarantine idea of keeping the ships off of the Venice port. Mm-hmm. So we know a lot of data, and we've done a lot of research. So influenza is something that you're comfortable with. It's that book that you always read. It's that show you always watch. And then you watch something new or you read something new. Mm-hmm. And yes, it may look like fear-mongering, but it's also confusion because you're getting so much information and you have to make sense of that information and drive down to, okay, what do we know? What do we don't know? And let's deal with what we know and how do we manage it?
Right. Can you go more into depth like you would, like you have in the last couple briefings that you gave us mm-hmm. at Secure the
Absolutely.
Grid? Because that depth of information is so important, and I think our friends that are listening out there will enjoy listening to that and learning from you about some of the more intricacies of this virus.
All right. So first of all, credit that much of the data in terms of the current numbers and rates comes from a variety of sources. One key source is the Coronis COVID-19 global cases display by the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. They have put together a dashboard that I've followed consistently since January 12th, when we started tracking this on a daily basis. And today, there's 178,508 confirmed cases. I want to say that is up 400 from when I wrote my notes 2 hours ago for this interview.
What was the final number, the latest number?
178,508 cases reported. Now, those are confirmed cases, which means that there has either been testing or some kind of diagnostic test, which could be a CAT scan, could be a medical opinion. All depends on how the 155 countries that are now impacted have reported. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind that when you had this the last interview in episode 45 on the 11th of February, you had 476 infected and 6 dead outside of China, mm-hmm. with 44,000 in China.
Mm-hmm.
Now, due to exponential increase as the every individual who's infected is going to provide this disease or infect somewhere around 1.5 to 3.5 additional people.
Mm.
So keep in mind that with flu, it's about one to one. If you have flu, you're probably going to get at least one other person sick. One means it's good endemic. That's where we want to drive that number to. So when we talk about social distancing, we're trying to drive the number down to one, which is called the R-naught, or the reproductive rate of the disease. So the reproductive rate of the disease is so high in some areas, like what we've seen in Italy and now Spain and Germany and San Francisco, New York, Seattle, that we're seeing exponential rise. And so today we have 4,093 cases in the United States, in addition out of that 178,000. That's a lot of people infected in a relatively short amount of time. You figure that's 5 weeks since you last since you talked about in episode 45, and we're now up to 175,000 from 476 total confirmed cases. Mm-hmm. So let's go on the actual case estimates. You know, just because we say that we got 178,000, that is not the actual number, because we're not testing the actual number. We don't know how many people actually have the disease. So we use models for those. Now, those models are really good for flu because we know how they work. Don't worry, we don't actually test a billion people for flu. We just guess based on our models. And our models say that over 5 million should have contracted the disease by now. Now, keep in mind that there is a long incubation period, and many of those people are going to be asymptomatic or mild and will never get tested. So we won't really know what that true number is. Out of the deaths, we don't know the actual deaths. China, for example, back in early February, forbid the diagnosis of being the cause of death as being pneumonia, because so many people are dying from pneumonia. Let's just eliminate that. And then if nobody died of pneumonia, then it couldn't have been COVID-19. Right now, 78,072 people are listed as recovered. Now, there's some recidivism, which means that up to 14% in one study of those people are either continuing to be contagious or they come back to the hospital and then go positive on a test again. We have good scientific data saying that everybody who gets sick with the disease is contagious for up to 5 weeks. That is also much longer than flu, so it spreads, the gift just keeps on giving for weeks at a time. The serious case rate, now this is important because everybody keeps focusing on the deaths. The dead, and I am an emergency manager, so I'm trying to be as civil as possible, but the dead are relatively easy to take care of.
Right.
Once the person has died, the case is over. And we can then deal with the mortuary issues and the religious issues of either burial or cremation or other ways to resolve the case. The real problem is that all these people are coming into the hospital and needing intensive care or critical care. They actually need a bed in a hospital. So the serious case rate is about 15 to 19% of everybody. So when we say that 178,000 are sick with confirmed cases, 18 to 19% of those are going to go to the hospital. 13.8% right now are on average are severe cases, and 4.7% are critical. They need ICU, intensive care unit. They need very specialized beds with specialized people, with specialized equipment that is managed by specially trained technicians. Those are people that, for example, need ventilators. Now, this isn't a flood. I want to use the exact words used out of Italy. This is not a flood. This is a tsunami. Hmm. It is all coming at once. When you compare with flu, flu is spread out over 8 months, and almost always the dead are people with pre-existing conditions, the people that are, unfortunately, the weakest out of that larger community. Mm-hmm. We're seeing people that are much younger than 60 ending up in the ICU in Italy, which is not consistent with the data out of China. So again, this is all new and evolving. Those over 60 and those with pre-existing conditions are most at risk, but that does not mean that they're the only ones at risk.
Right.
And every bed, there's only 97 to 98,000 ICU beds in the United States. Out of any one day, 93,000 of those could be filled. Now, you'll see other estimates that say 65,000 of those are filled, but in a heavy flu season, we're probably somewhere around 90% or greater capacity in ICUs. And yet now we're going to flood that with 4.7% of all those people who are sick. The case fatality rate, the actual dead, is somewhere around 3.4% per the World Health Organization. You've heard Trump and others comment that that's not true. Well, the actual answer is it's an average. There are countries with 0%, mm-hmm. and there's countries like Iran and Italy that are approaching 5% or greater. Mm. So when we say 3.4%, we mean, well, it depends where you are in that exponential spread.
Right.
As your health system gets overwhelmed, so Iran's got overwhelmed way before Italy's, but in both cases, the health system is overwhelmed and they don't have time for testing. They have time for treatment. And then if they recover, get them out of the bed. So with the beds available, keep in mind, they're contagious for 5 weeks. So this is a long treatment mm-hmm. with those beds not turning over and relatively few of those people dying and therefore the cases resolved. So they're dealing with this tsunami of information, this tsunami of people where they don't have time to differentiate whether that's viral meningitis or that's gastrointestinal or respiratory. We're treating everybody that we can, and they're making huge decisions about triage, which person gets that last ventilator.
Right. Well, in Italy, I read that anybody of who's over a certain age, they're not even going to try and provide any care to them.
Yeah, most of them are actually, let's just clarify that most of them are saying they're going to give palliative and supportive care.
Yeah,
They're not going to be able to provide definitive care that might resolve the disease because they no longer have the tools. There's only so much medicine and so many ventilators to go around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this disease not only lasts a long time, it takes a long time to present. So 2 to 14 days is the incubation period that you hear from CDC and WHO. You hear that 5.1 days is the mean and 7 days is the average. So if you believe you were exposed to a patient and you waited 7 days and you have not shown symptoms, you're at the 80% mark. Mm-hmm. Most of the people would have been there. Now, you could go as far as 14 days. That's fewer people. And then in a handful of known documented cases, it's been as long as 24 to 27 days from exposure to symptomatic and or confirmed. So here's the problem. When we say testing, when you hear the fact that the U.S. has tested somewhere between 21 and 30,000 tests, well, that's only 15,000 patients in the best scenario.
Right.
So every person requires two tests because you want to know that it wasn't just a fluke. You want to know that it's right. So two tests, but some people are requiring up to 20 tests before they get diagnosed as positive.
Wow. That's a lot of resources.
Yes. And the trouble is because you're saying, I'm going to do a throat swab. Well, one, like in drive-through testing, if I give you a throat swab, are you pushing it all the way down or are you kind of pushing it to your tongue and then taking it out?
Yeah.
So are you doing the test right?
Not consistent.
Then the viral load needs to be high enough for the test to actually come back positive. And
right.
if you're asymptomatic or worse yet, you're in this incubation period where the body's still starting to produce the virus, but the virus hasn't like gone up to the throat yet and you're not coughing it out, you're going to show up as negative despite the fact that weeks later you might be positive.
Wow. What do you see as a worst case and a best case scenario for the United States? If you got out your crystal ball and was able to say, okay, based on these numbers, this would be this and this would be that, or are you able to do a best or worst?
Well, I can. I think one thing I'd mention just before we move to that is that We know that this transmits via droplets. So you've heard social distancing of 6 feet away, and that way the droplet doesn't get into your respiratory tract.
Right.
You've heard that it also transmits via fecal. This is a disease that transmits via waste product.
Right.
There is good evidence that it is aerosol.
Yes.
And that aerosolized means that it is not necessarily airborne in the way measles are airborne or Legionnaire's disease, but it is aerosolized and therefore can stay in the air much longer than previously expected. It also stays on surfaces, on like metal, in a nice, cool, dry, medium humidity environment. You're talking 5 or more days.
Yeah.
Unless it's clean. So given that rate of transmission of 1.5 to 3.5 people that are going to get infected from every person who's infected, I would say that the estimate is 50 to 70% of the population is going to be exposed and contract the disease. Now, that is consistent with most pandemics. It's, think of it as a wildfire. You know how we build wildfire breaks?
Yes.
We take down all the trees, we backburn the fuel.
Right.
And then the fire stops, right?
Yes.
That's social distancing.
Okay.
So the disease is going to keep spreading as long as it finds somebody to spread to. And then sooner or later, enough people will be exposed that it won't find somebody to infect. So I'll get the disease and I'll walk up to somebody who's already had it or who, takes the proper social distancing, and the virus can't spread from me to somebody else. So 50 to 70% is about expected via most of the models. 80% of those cases are going to be mild or asymptomatic. The trouble is this disease transmits while asymptomatic. There is good medical research showing that it's possible to continue to spread the disease while asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is you're not doing as much coughing when you're asymptomatic. So you're not as likely to do that unless you like stick your fingers in your mouth and then touch a surface or there are ways. It's just not as easy.
Right. Right.
But those people are going to largely walk around and continue to spread the disease unless they do social distancing.
Right.
Small to no impact on children and infants. Okay. We don't know if children are not getting it. We just know that their immune system is strong enough so that they're not symptomatic. So as we get more tests, we'll know that's the whole issue about closing schools is to keep, let's admit that schools are little viral outbreak chambers.
Oh yeah.
And we stop the schools not to prevent the kids from necessarily dying. It's from the kids carrying back the disease. Even if they physically don't demonstrate the disease, even if they're not asymptomatic, they mm-hmm. never caught the disease. They're bringing back their backpack. They're bringing back the bottom of the soles of their shoes that might have touched fomites that might spread the disease into, say, their grandparents' house.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
vaccines 10 to 16 months away. They're going fast. You're going to hear that today they're starting human trials. One, you have to do human trials with people that are actually sick. You can't just do, nobody died that was already healthy. So we have to do human trials, which takes time, but then we have to produce enough of the vaccine and then distribute the vaccine across a relatively vaccine resistant community.
Well, we have enough people around the world to experiment on, I'm sure.
Yes, but I'm saying human trials take time.
Yes.
You have to know that it's going to work, and you have to know that it's safe for the people who take it that
right.
don't have the disease.
Right.
Keep in mind that when you say we vaccinated against smallpox, there was a fraction of a percent that either were very sick or in a few cases died because of the smallpox vaccine. So you have to be very careful, and you have to have enough body of evidence to know that people with all sorts of other conditions will successfully take the vaccine, develop the antibodies, and resist future infection.
Okay.
So you asked the question of worst case versus best case.
Yes.
We are past best case. the exponential spread that we see in the U.S. is tracking right along with Italy. We have good data out of Italy, and if you look at the numbers, we are about a week, week and a half behind Italy in terms of the exponential spread.
Yeah, that's what I heard over the weekend.
Yes, we will see tens of thousands of confirmed cases because we are ramping up testing. You expect to see more cases.
Right.
We also have community to community spread. So not only are we seeing human to human spread, like, say, New York or Seattle, but we're seeing those people then infect somebody else in a different community. So somebody comes from Seattle and goes skiing. Here in Colorado, they just suspended downhill ski operations for a week, which is unprecedented, but it's done because we get visitors from all over. That community to community spread means it's, for example, Denver is behind Seattle or San Francisco or New York, but is ahead of, say, Omaha or Lincoln, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see these different waves of the tsunami come through the United States. Now, where's that range for cases? Somewhere between 124 to 214 million people will get the disease if the models play out. Again, the more social distancing we do, the more dramatic and aggressive we do in terms of social distancing, we can change these numbers.
Right.
But if we do what we're doing right now, which is everybody's kind of doing their own little thing and there's wide variability. I mean, there's places holding parties and holding the same day that Austin canceled South by Southwest, Houston went ahead with 70,000 person rodeo. So when you have two cities in the same state do two completely different actions, you're going to continue this spread.
Right.
So if you had the low end, 124 million, you'd look at potential deaths of up to 200,000. You'd look at up to 1.7 million dead in the absolute worst case. I don't believe that the worst case is in any way likely or any way confirmed. Somewhere in there, we're going to have to deal with the, no matter what the numbers play out in terms of the final numbers, in the next month and a half, to maybe 2 months, you're going to see the hospital systems across the U.S., not just the ones in, say, New York or Seattle, overwhelmed with the number of patients that they need to provide either treatment for severe or critical reactions to COVID-19.
So, and this, we only have a couple minutes left, but this could mean a huge economic downturn, and it could affect government services that are provided to everybody, and as well as overwhelming the medical side, but the ambulance and fire rescue, all that will be taxed beyond belief, and those guys will be exposed to the virus, and many of those will be victims of it, and that'll degrade that service even more. The possibility of societal collapse or severe degradation is something that people should really think about, isn't it?
I would say that they need to be prepared for a new normal. That's the phrase we usually use in emergency management to say things are not going to return and snap back to the way they were.
Right.
Some of that could be because of supply chain impacts, which we will see much more of in April than we have so far. Those supply chain impacts, the impacts of closures, we will see airlines, cruise industry, rail industry, all see either bankruptcies or massive losses. We will see all these effects of these, what we call restriction of movement orders. I'm tired of saying the word isolation and quarantine, and those mean different things to different people. But as you restrict movement, you're going to see continued stock market volatility because there's uncertainty.
Right.
And uncertainty breeds volatility in the market. You're going to see challenges with elections. You're going to see challenges with the census 2020, which kicked off this month.
Yeah,
we need to, you know, really look at how we transition not only our internal long-term supply chains and transportation and build an American public health system because we don't have one. But we also need to realize that this is going to change people's perception of what is acceptable. So I have four recommendations. I don't know if that's we have enough time. I'll just try to be quick.
Yeah, please be quick.
But those four are prepared community. We need to prepare our community for all hazards, not just, you know, just because there's a pandemic does not mean that there's not going to be a house fire, a tornado, or war. An example is the Health and Human Services is suffering a cyber attack right now at the same time that they're trying to mobilize.
That's convenient.
That's an emergency plan for you, your family, your business, your community, with 21 to 30 days of food, water, medications, power, and protection with the necessary skills and abilities to do that. We need to get that down to the neighborhood and the community level.
Right.
Two, we need aggressive and comprehensive social distancing to flatten the curve. We need to reduce the overall impact, but really we want to spread out the number of people when they go to the hospital. The more this looks like the flu, the easier it is to deal with, because the more we're talking months instead of days where these ICU patients show up, the more that capacity is going to be able to be generated, and we're going to be able to successfully take care of people, which is going to better their outcomes and reduce the number of fatalities. Just like you just said, we need to protect and strengthen both our public health and emergency services capabilities. That means expanding capacity. It means sustaining the resources. I was the Urban Area Security Initiative authority for both Denver and San Jose, California. And in both cases, I saw thousands and thousands of sets of everything we need and the drugs we need and the materials we need go to waste, expire, and not be replaced. And they're not replaced because there's not enough money. In Denver, we lost 88% of federal funding over the last 15 years for anything related to emergency management, homeland security, and pandemic preparedness. 88%. And meanwhile, the city can't replace all that. So the city and county were late doing that because nobody had told them, oh, by the way, all this stuff that the feds bought you, yeah, you're going to have to sustain. So that we hadn't built it into our budgets. I started doing that as the emergency manager there, but you'll find that vast majority of emergency management departments, I know you refer a lot to civil defense, are still funded under the civil defense model. One person, 50% federal pay, 50% local pay, usually $30,000 to $40,000 a year.
Yeah, and sometimes they have an assistant assigned to them, but it's usually a one- or two-man shop. It's not enough resources to perform such a crucial position. Yes. That's why we need civil defense again. That's why we need it to be a grassroots initiative and help our local communities, whether it's a city or county.
Well, and it needs to be grassroots, but it needs to be also government supported.
Yeah.
I mean, the government, my role as an emergency manager is to coordinate the whole of government and the whole of community efforts. It's not to provide.
Exactly.
If you think I'm going to provide you food and water as a million-person city, the answer is no.
No,
we can't
way,
do it.
No way.
Yeah. And then the last recommendation I'll just make is that aggressive economic and social support for individuals, families, and businesses impacted by the social distancing.
Yeah.
Especially that's the 25 to 30 million people without health insurance, the 45 million people without sick leave, and our homeless populations.
Yeah.
So those are my four recommendations and actions. I think some jurisdictions are taking those, not all. At the end of the day, I'll leave you with this, that our success relies on your preparedness. It's something that I've repeated all throughout my emergency management career. At the end of the day, whether or not emergency management is successful is solely dependent upon the preparedness of the individual, the family, the community.
Yes, and that means that civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with a guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings of the threats we see on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio. I wish to thank Ryan again for being on the show this week, and I want to thank you, our friends and listeners, who are with us this week as well. I really appreciate you being with us and listening to our show and giving us so much support. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.